Hey, folks, this is Mark Maron from the podcast WTF. And really, why are you listening to Mr. Media Radio?
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to a real literary legend, Bruce J. Friedman. He's the man behind the movies Splash, Stir Crazy, and The Heartbreak Kid, plays such as Steam Bath and Scuba Dooba, and novels such as Stern and The Dick. He just published his must-read memoir, Lucky Bruce. Stick around. This is the first time that the father of one of my previous guests ever dropped by the show. Usually it's their lawyer. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of famous writers, brand name celebrities, and their heirs, who are mentioned in Lucky Bruce and are standing by to see what Mr. Friedman might say about them next in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. How many guys can write an autobiography that is part Andy Warhol Diaries, part Zelig, and part Forrest Gump? Even if you've never read a lick of Bruce J. Friedman's voluminous career output or seen one of his movies or Broadway productions, I guarantee you'll find his new memoir, Lucky Bruce, delightful. Why delightful? Because it's not the story of a guy standing on his mother's stoop begging you to notice him and pay attention. His substantial collection of life stories and career anecdotes weave a history of a guy who, well, by his own telling, wandered in and out of history. The accidental success, you might call it, or American Splendor, Manhattan edition. There is Friedman, who fell into a top editing job at Magazine Management Company, run by Martin Goodman, who, you might know, also created Marvel Comics, which employed his nephew, a guy named Stan Lee. While there, Friedman hired and befriended a guy you may also have heard of, named Mario Puzo. Along the way to Lucky, Friedman declines the top editing job at Playboy, gets into a street fight with Norman Mailer, parties with Crazy Joe Gallo, takes a leak next to Muhammad Ali, writes the screenplays for Splash and Stir Crazy, and, well, frankly, I dog-eared so many pages of note that my dog ears have dog ears. Now, I should note that this wonderful opportunity to interview Bruce came about as a result of my friendship with his son, famed caricaturist and illustrator of old Jewish comedians, Drew Friedman. Drew has been a guest here, and it was he who suggested a conversation with his dad and opened that door. Thank you, Drew. Bruce J. Friedman, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you for having me on.
It's my pleasure. I have to tell you, before I even ask you the first question, I have to tell you my first memory of your work. and this is of a book cover. I was in the library of Anshiamath Temple in New Brunswick, New Jersey. This is in the early 70s. And I was killing time trying not to be found when I should have been in Mr. Martyr's bar mitzvah class. I saw on a bookshelf The Dick by Bruce J. Friedman. I didn't take it off the shelf. I didn't dare. But the title, it made me giggle. And I know it's kind of Beavis and Butthead of me to acknowledge that, but the fact is that was my first introduction to Bruce J. Friedman. And I have to admit, it's 40 years later, I never had the nerve to read the book. I didn't understand at the time that The Dick was a reference to a detective. I just thought that you were the most accepted writer on the face of the earth who could title a book like that and get it into the Temple Library. So that's where I begin my knowledge of Bruce J. Friedman.
Well, my reference for the book was the Homicide Bureau in Chicago. And homicide cops were called dicks, just very casually. And my daughter, who's now 27, once in a while scolds me and says, "How do you think it was for a little girl, a five-year-old girl and her friends, to see that her passed every day the shelves and see that her father had written a book called The Dick? How do you think that made me feel?"
Oh, and the kids look for any opportunity to tease, don't they? Wow. Well, you know, I want to ask you to pick your favorite among your children. You've three boys and a daughter. But can you pick among the plays and the books and the screenplays, even if it's one in each category, which one is your favorite? Do you have favorites?
Well, you always favor the runt of the litter, or the child didn't get quite as much attention as the others. So my feelings tend to drift in that direction. I wrote a book called About Harry Towns, and it was acknowledged by some people I respect. I thought it would do a little better. I thought it would, but it's lasted, and it keeps coming up. There's a story of mine about literary envy, which is included in a collection of mine. That's a favorite because it's so nasty. It really is vicious, quietly, and I think in a subtle way. That's a favorite. I don't think anybody ever paid any attention to it. It was published. So I've got a few. But other than that, my focus is always never on what I wrote, but what I'm going to write tomorrow or even tonight.
I, to be honest, I was expecting, based on the fondness with which you wrote about it, that you might have said Stern, your first novel.
Well, there's something about a first novel, a first publication, a first acceptance of a novel. My favorite, well, you know, I wrote it when I was less than half my age. And if I were to write it, the culture was so different. If I were to write it today, especially since it dealt somewhat with Jewish affairs, I would write it differently. That was pre the 1967 Israeli victory. And I think that changed the attitudes of a lot of Jews. And I think Stern would not have fit into the new culture quite. Favorite? Yeah, because something about getting a first novel accepted or a first play. Turning that you thought you'd have to leave the country because it was so awful, and it turning out to be a magical hit. Those were some high points, and they became some of my favorites.
How much material throughout the book you reference things that you've written that didn't get published? How much unpublished material is there in your catalog?
Now, let me put it this way. Anything that should be published has been published. There are 2.5 or 3.5 novels that I haven't written off entirely, that I may, the fate's permitting me enough time, I may go back to. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of plays that, quote, need work. I may go back to them. And there are some short stories that are in work that I'm working on now that aren't quite there. But that's the way it works. Sometimes it'll take 2 years, as long as 2 years, before I know exactly the way a story should come off. Why does it happen that way? Who knows? So there's quite a bit that's not been published, and quite a bit that has. Yeah.
Is there anything that you've gone back and looked at that has been unpublished that you think that the editors missed the mark on over the years, that they really just didn't get it, or that you could go back and that you were able to go back and correct or make it work better?
Without question. I wrote a sequel to Stern called Stern Kills, The Way Comedians Kill. And I submitted it to a few people, and I kind of lost confidence in it and put it aside. But I read it recently, and if I'm permitted to say so, I was really, really struck by the power of it and the energy. And again, if I'm allowed to say this, how good it was. Now, I seem to recall there was a flaw maybe midway along that I conveniently didn't get to in my rereading. But that's something, again, that I plan to go back to.
Now, in the introduction, I describe you, and I'm curious to get your response to this, as sort of an accidental success in some ways, and that in reading your version of your life, I don't always get the sense that you were this great powder keg of ambition, or that you were driven in a particular way. You knew you wanted to write, and you knew you had to make a living to, you know, put food on the table for your wife and kids. But I didn't always get the sense that there was this big plan for you, that you had it all figured out. At times it seemed like you kind of, I don't know, for lack of a better word, maybe drifted early on in your career from place to place and opportunity to opportunity, rather than being so focused on where you wanted to be.
I never had a career plan, but I did have perhaps concealed drive, which I still have now, that need to tell stories, to finish one and get on to the next one. At the beginning, I didn't think I knew enough to, quote, fill up a whole story or a book. Now, with, you know, the clock ticking, I don't have anywhere enough time to sort of accommodate all the ideas that I have. Curiosity always was controlling. I'd get curious. I'd write a novel and get curious about the theater. Why not try the theater? And when that worked out pretty well. It was someone in a steam bath said to me, after I'd written two successful novels, two plays, bunch of short stories. I'll still remember this. This guy said, "I notice I've never seen your name on the big screen." So that sort of propelled me to Hollywood. There's always a they out there. There's always someone who'll tell you, "I haven't quite done this." There's an actress whose name you'd know who asked me. I've done a little. It isn't quite acting, but I've had a few cameos. Who said, "I notice you've never done any poetry." And it's true. I have. There's always something you have. And I'm curious. To me, it's all storytelling in a different form.
There was also a woman you quote in the book who's describing your success as spotty, I think, at one point, which you found very amusing.
Well, in Southampton, they had women like that.
Uh-huh.
Had to really watch your back. Who would give you kind of a needle. And she was a needler. And I began to think, and I guess it was spotty. The spots were terrific.
Yeah. Just so you know, I don't know how much you get out, but there's women like that in Florida, too. I'm pretty much everywhere I've been. Well, that's enough about me. was it tough... to go back and you know, have to examine your own life and look at the things you've done and the decisions that you made, and then frame them in a way that you were comfortable telling them? Was that a difficult process?
Well, the whole struggle was getting the voice. What voice do I want to use of the seven different voices that I have? I mean, do I want to have my Noel Coward voice? Or do I want to have my candid voice, wide-eyed and innocent? What voice am I comfortable with? That was once I decided to make it semi-conversational, yet not entirely, because that can be a bore. Once I got settled into a certain voice, I wouldn't even be able to describe it. The book was relatively easy to write, much more so than my other work, meaning there was less vomiting, which makes me suspicious. Makes me suspicious about the book. I don't remember struggling enough to write it.
Well, I would tell anyone watching this that the voice that you're hearing coming from this man now in this interview is very similar to the voice that you pick up in reading Lucky Bruce. It's rather self-effacing. It's insightful. And it moves along. One of the things that struck me in reading this is, and I read a lot of biography, I like to write biography and work with people on their autobiographies, and one of the things that struck me is that you don't spend pages upon pages upon pages on a single anecdote the way some people have done when they've written their memoirs. I mean, we get Norman Mailer in like a half a page, but the picture is created. We get Anthony Perkins in a page, but it's very clear what Anthony Perkins was like in your experience. I guess part of that speaks to the vast number of experiences and people that you've seen in the course of your career.
Well, you work all your life as a writer to learn concision, to learn to say more with less space. I don't think it was a matter of accommodating all the folks I've met so much as getting a handle on an individual as quickly as possible. It's in the book. When I met Tony Curtis, the first thing he said to me was, "You are a perfect candidate for hair transplant." Well, tells you quite a bit about him, which seemed to me. I think the second remark was he told me that he gets special underwear shipped in from Sweden. The implication being that I think as a writer, it was my obligation to get him his underwear. But I mean, those two remarks are Tony Curtis, seems to me.
Yeah.
You don't need much more.
I never had the pleasure of meeting him, although a friend of mine, Peter Gollenbach, did co-write his Tony's autobiography, which came out just before he passed. So I'm going to share that with Peter. I think he'll enjoy that story if he didn't already hear it. I like that. Were there any incidents from your past that you did have trouble writing about? And I'm thinking about one area in particular. It was more personal. I found that you were fairly careful about the way you wrote about your first marriage. Obviously, you had three children. You clearly paint a picture where it was not a good experience. A lot of it may have been going through the motions. But I wondered if that was tough to have to put that on paper, because you knew you had to if you're going to write this book.
Well, I skipped over the edges lightly. It's all in my fiction. I took care of it pretty much in my fiction. The play Scuba Duba. It's not autobiographical entirely, but it has the seeds of what was going on. And I clearly mark this as a literary memoir. And I'll probably disappoint some of my kids because I didn't write enough about them, or a friend, how come you didn't include me? It wasn't that kind of book. I wanted it to be strictly a literary memoir.
I'm sorry, Bruce, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, the other would just be en passant, so to speak, you know.
Have the boys and Molly, have they read the book yet?
Molly read the book, and she helped me find some typos that I missed. There are quite a few. And what struck her, and her only comment, was it was gratifying to her. She's 27, and she's struggling to do some writing, because it seems to be necessary to my children, all of whom had the good grace not to write, be novelists. They've written other kinds of things. But what struck Molly was that, and was useful to her, was the struggle to get that first book done, to have spent 4 or 5 years working on a novel that simply didn't work. I wasn't born to be a novel, which I knew down deep was true, like pushing a car uphill, without any help. But that led me into writing what I thought was a pretty good novel. All this was fresh to her. She appeared to think that all I did was snap my fingers and I was starting to publish all over the place. Not true.
Well, here's what I'd like to do. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about some specific projects and people in your life. This is Bob Andelman, and you're listening to and hopefully watching the Mr. Media interview with legendary writer Bruce J. Friedman, whose new literary memoir is Lucky Bruce. And we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Guy Kawasaki. You're listening to Mr. Media, you poor slob.
Hey, folks. You can hear Mr. Media while on the go now with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news and talk mobile app available for your smartphone, whether you use an iPhone, iPod Touch, Android, BlackBerry Curve, or Palm Pre. And when you download Stitcher to hear Mr. Media today, you have a chance to win some real money. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher in your smartphone's app store. Download it, it's free, takes seconds. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter Mr. Media, that's MR Media, to get automatically entered to win $100. The latest episode of Mr. Media will be waiting for you in Stitcher's favorites right on your phone. You'll get access to lots of other amazing shows, too, always available to you on demand, no syncing. Some of my favorites include WTF with Mark Maron, Plus One Per Diem with Kevin Smith, and The Nerdist with Chris Hardwick. It's all free and all instant to you on Stitcher Smart Radio. And don't forget to win the money. Enter promo code Mr. Media, MR Media, when you register. And thanks for listening. This is Bob Andelman, and you're listening to and hopefully watching the Mr. Media interview with legendary writer Bruce J. Friedman, whose new literary memoir is Lucky Bruce, and it is a hell of a read. I mean, you just, you know, you know what I think the smart thing about this book is, Bruce? It's that I mentioned the Andy Warhol diaries at the top of the show. You don't have, the book is an index, so people actually have to go and read the book to see where they're mentioned, if they're, you know, if they're lucky enough to be in here, if they're still, you know, still with us. So many people at the front of the book, unfortunately, are not, but.
I mentioned mentioned this to the publisher not once but three times, got no response. Always comes down to money. I think they would have had to hire a special person to do the index, but I would have preferred to have one.
Well, I think it works out either way. You got to read the book. I mean, it's just such a hoot, and it's just a fascinating to me. The people and the places that you've, I mean, it sounds like I'm quoting Dr. Seuss, but the people and you've met and the places you've been, it's just crazy. But I got to ask you a really important question first before we get into that. Why Bruce J. Friedman? Was there another Bruce Friedman in your circles, or?
When I started thinking about writing, all the writers, I wanted to be a photojournalist. All the photojournalists had three names. It was David Douglas Duncan and Henri Cartier-Bresson. They all had three names. I had three names. So I thought, well, why not use the three names? That's half the story.
Okay.
The other half was affectation. A young man's affectation.
And there we have it. Now we know. Oh, my goodness. I had no idea.
Now I'm stuck with it because I started to get published at a very early age. I suddenly had a lot of stuff being published, and it became, if you'll permit me, almost a brand, so that I wouldn't have been recognized quite. So I just let it stay and opened the door to questions like that.
That's good. And you know, the funny thing is, I look at it now and I think, by Bruce Friedman, it just doesn't have the same ring. It doesn't, you know, that middle name has been very good to you all these years.
Well, I don't know. It hasn't. I guess it hasn't held me back.
Doesn't seem like it. You know, but, you know, there's still plenty of time. It may still turn out to have been a bad choice. Who knows? So, you know, I'm sure there's not many people who are that interested in Martin Goodman, but I've talked to Stan. I was a comics guy all my life. I'm sure Drew has an interest in this guy. Why did he? You kind of preface your comments about him by telling us how difficult he was for a lot of people to get along with, and that he could be, I think, a little on the cheap side. But he really liked you. What do you suppose was the difference with you and other people?
I think he liked me because I wasn't afraid of him. There were people I needed the job, but I felt I was just doing it until I could get started as a writer. So as a result, even with three kids and no money particularly, and a mortgage, I was not afraid of him, and he could be terrifying, mostly by using just a few words. He had a thin cigar,
right. You
know, and said very little. When you put out a magazine, it wasn't doing too well, he'd drop by your office with the thin cigar and tap it once and say, "It's not moving." It was sort of chilling if you let it get the best of you. But the job never met. I mean, I did the job professionally, but also with my left hand.
Right.
And I lucked into that job. Well, there's lucky again, in a sense that it did not. I was editor of four magazines. I had to buy 70 stories a month, or the equivalent. Yet. At the end of the day, the 9-to-5 day, my head was clear, and I could, on the train and at night, I could work on what I called my real writing. Had I worked for Time or Newsweek, where I couldn't get a job, or Life, or Collier's, or any of the other, quote, legitimate publishing houses, I might have had a job as a correspondent, and not been able to write my stories and my books. So it was a perfect arrangement for me. I had a certain skill of all things. I mean, I thought I was going to wind up in the stockroom at my dad's company where he was a laborer. That was my aspiration. I mean, I thought that's what would happen.
Ladies underwear, right?
Yeah. I had a certain skill, an administrative skill, and I had to, I hired very good people. I found out that was the trick, to hire, not be afraid of people, and not be afraid of Mario Puzo, that he was going to take my job. And I would run into a lot of frightened people. In that one area of my life, I had no fear. Now I have a little fear. But I was too stupid and too young, you know, to understand what was going on.
It seemed like Martin did respect you, obviously, and late in the game he wanted to basically throw the whole thing to you and almost work for you, and you just kind of walked away from it.
That's exactly correct. There were two, in 1965, there were two people from the electronics business who acquired the company and had no experience. We had lunch, and they, you know, gave me a blank check, whatever you want. Martin Goodman would essentially, unthinkably, be reporting to me. That was a factor, but more of a factor was that I had lost interest in it. I simply had no interest. I didn't want to. I had written my last Nympho King of G.I. Island story, and I wanted to get on with it. And I figured, I was 35, it really wasn't that old, but to me it was. And I had written, I had some something to build on. I had written A Mother's Kisses, which was a big bestseller at the time. Not that it made that much money, but I decided I don't want to have anything to do with the editing of magazines anymore. You could have offered me The New Yorker, which nobody did. But I was offered Playboy in 1965. didn't seem like much of a step up to me, although it did to them. They were astonished. I had no interest in that. Well, writing for Playboy, fine. Writing for Esquire, fine. But going that 9-to-5 thing, that was over.
Weren't interested in landing at the home of the Dark Triangle, huh? That's what you're saying.
Yeah. Right.
And so at the Martin Goodman's company, you run into a guy named Puzo. Do you remember your first impressions of this guy?
Well, I didn't quite run into him. I had an opening for a job, and there were two candidates. One was Arthur Kretschmer, who later became the editor of Playboy for many decades.
A job that you turned down.
Well, there were two of them in one job. I knew that Kretschmer was good. Puzo was the other candidate. I knew he was a writer, and I knew he had published a few books, and I didn't need just a smart guy, which Kretschmer was. I needed somebody who could write some of those 70 stories that I needed. So I hired Mario on that basis in 1960. Whenever his name comes up, if you'll permit me, there's one story I can't resist telling. And we all did moonlighting. We did our jobs responsibly. But late at night, we would work on, quote, our own work. And he came into my office one day, sheepishly said he was working on a book, and he wanted to try out the title. He's thinking of calling it The Godfather. What do you think? And I said, well, frankly, it doesn't do much for me, Mario. You know, I mean, it sounds domestic. Who wants to read about that? Would we put that in one of our magazines? Why don't you give it another try? So there was a look of stone came over his face. He's a short, fat guy, but you would not want to see that look again, ever. And the curious thing about it is I was right for any other book but The Godfather.
Yeah. Wow.
But, again, irresistible story, as there are many irresistible stories about Puzo, who's like a very strong spice that you may have put too much into a recipe and it takes over.
Right.
So, in other words, there should be an entire book about Mario.
Would you have guessed when you hired him that you would be friends with him and that he'd be a factor in your life pretty much the whole rest of the way?
No.
Is he a good friend to have?
The best.
Yeah.
The best. No, that just developed. You know, I actually left the company before he did, treacherously, in 65. He followed soon after he had written The Godfather, and the money came in like an oil well. As you said, it came in, especially after the movie, so fast the studios didn't have time to hide
it. Yeah, that was a great line. I love that.
Yeah.
And then they screwed him on Godfather 2.
Screwed him. He probably made more money in the altogether than probably any other writer, it would seem to me, that I know of. Screwed him in a sense that the first film was made for nickels and dimes with actors that nobody ever heard of. Al Pacino, Jimmy Caan, Brando. Heard of, but to hire them for the second film, the budget went from $3 million to $12 million. It's still pennies by today's standards. But Mario, even though he started out with 2% of the first movie, and now had 12%, the 12% meant nothing.
Right.
The 2% meant a lot because the budget was so small.
I like the part. I guess it's just the writer in me that liked this part where you had a conversation with him about net gross versus gross, and yeah, it's just interesting. Well, I want to ask you. I have to ask you about Norman Mailer, and I don't want to ask you to recount the story of the street fight, which is in the book, but I'm more curious. Why do you suppose he was so antagonistic to so many people? Did he feel inferior? Did he feel superior? What? I mean, you've been with the man. Why was he the way he was?
I can't give you a definitive explanation. For one thing, he was small. So if you look at photographs of him, these are just theories. He always had a glass in front of his hand at a cocktail party. And it was not because it was comfortable holding it that way. I began to think it was a defensive thing. He's worried about his height. He's worried about talent or real ability. And I think when he sensed that, he got very competitive. I'll show off for a minute. My papers are archived at the Berg Archive. They don't have his papers. What they do have is a file on disputes that Norman Mailer had with a long list of people. They have that correspondence. That's quite impressive. In my case, who knows? It was complicated. He always wanted to write it, you know, had a dream of writing a play open on Broadway. He was envious of Arthur Miller with Marilyn Monroe thrown into the bargain. That didn't happen. He had that one play, Deer Park, which was a struggle from the beginning. I don't think it was his fault. That's another story. I think it was the director had the worst directorial idea I've ever heard, which didn't help. At the same time, simultaneously, I had written a first play, Scuba-Dooba, and amazingly, it took off. You could not get a ticket. That bothered him, I know. And also, I reminded him, I was told, of somebody who would beat him mercilessly in tennis at Harvard.
Fine. Of all so, things.
Put them all together.
Makes sense. Now, and I'm skipping around a little bit here, but reading the book, I get a sense that you did, and you didn't mention this up front, but that you up front in the interview, but you, I sense a good a bit of pride in terms of your association with the film Stir Crazy. And Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor. I wondered if you had any private moments with them that kind of that you could share. I guess particularly with Pryor.
I met Wilder before he went out to Hollywood and became Gene Wilder. He was a particular fan of my book Stern. Pryor was a different story. My friendship was. Began, I guess, on the set of Stir Crazy when I saw Sidney Poitier had brought in a writer to kind of clean in his head to clean up the dialogue, whatever, and I had never had that experience. Basically, I was told to stand aside. I was fired and then brought back in again. But I visited the set, and I saw Gene Wilder pat the mechanical bull, if you recall the movie, and say, "Nice horsey, nice horsey." Well, I didn't write "nice horsey." I wouldn't write "nice horsey" with a gun to my head. Bedwetters say "nice horsey." What? Do not say my... So I turned around and my ears were smoking. I didn't realize the process. You know. Richard Pryor, who was known as the Wild Man, would treat your dialogue with such reverence and not change a semicolon. Gene Wilder, bless him, would see it as a starting point for him to write dialogue that was... he felt was more comfortable for him. So I decided to leave the set, and Pryor was smart enough to know that I was hurt and managed to turn it around in my favor by saying, "I never met a writer like you. You take the money, don't take any shit, excuse my language. I never know. I think I'll do the same. I have 50 in cash," he said. "I believe I'll do the same." And sure enough, he did disappear from the set. But he turned what he sensed was my hurt, which I thought was concealed, into a positive thing for me, that I was in command of the situation. He was that smart and smarter. And, yeah, I had sort of a friendship. I wouldn't see him, you know, every day, but I'd see him, not run into him now and then. And unfortunately, I saw him when he had wasted away to nothing up in his home. A miracle that he lasted as long as he did.
You also provided the material that Steve Martin, for the Steve Martin movie, The Lonely Guy. I'm not discounting Gene Wilder at all, but I think Steve Martin and Richard Pryor were a different type of talent. Do you see any similarities between those two men?
Which two are we
talking
about?
I'm sorry, Pryor and Martin.
No. Except that they were, in my experience, both very, very modest and decent men. But the comedy is 180 degrees separate. They're both gifted in different ways.
Both very much of their time. They very much understood their audience and what they could offer their audience.
Pryor was a real social critic, I thought, behind the comedy. Steve was comedy, the comedy personified.
Right. Well, speaking of comedians, and we'll kind of wind up here, I think, your son Drew, who I've gotten to know the last couple of years, has created almost a second or third career for himself by drawing pictures of old Jewish comedians. And I got to ask you, most of them are before his time, a lot of them before his time. He's moved up to the more current, but did you see that one coming? Is that something you would have guessed that he would have done?
Well, he has Drew, among his many skills, he has great humanity, it seems to me. And somehow he found it in the faces of these people. No, I didn't see it coming. Flaubert said, give me stories that will astonish me. Well, I've had sons and children who astonish me. And Drew is right up there at the top. I mean, he just astonishes me.
It's amazing, the stuff that he produces, always has been. And for people who don't know, at the very least, let me tell you that on the cover of one of his books, it says, there's a quote from Howard Stern who says, he calls Drew his favorite artist ever. Something to that effect. I'm paraphrasing, but that's
better than Picasso.
Better than Picasso. There you go. There you go. All right. So I want to wind up the interview with a question that is where I actually started with Drew many years ago. Now it's been 7 or 8 years. We were introduced because of the. I almost hate to bring this up because of the biography I wrote of Will Eisner. And in there, Eisner had talked about Drew as a student back at the School of Visual Arts, and he said that he had some trouble with Drew, and that he at one time had picked up the phone and called you and talked to you about your son, and you agreed that Drew was a handful, and Drew said he went and asked you, and that never happened. And so I just want to ask you for the record, did Will Eisner ever call you to talk to you about your son, Drew?
Never happened, and I wouldn't have appreciated it.
Had a feeling at this point that was the case, but I had to ask you on the record for all to see.
Sorry, but never happened.
Not a problem, not a problem. Well, folks, listen, you can find Bruce J. Friedman's absolutely compelling literary memoir, Lucky Bruce. It's such a great read. I mean, I hope you can tell just from listening to the interview and my enthusiasm for the stories in it how much I've enjoyed it. But you can find it in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. Bruce, I know we had to twist your arm to get you to do a video interview. Can people find you online? Are you an online guy at all?
Not particularly, but you've opened up a whole new world. Skype, I can't get enough of. Yeah, I was in terror. I lived in fear of it, but once I more or less have the hang of it, there'll be no stopping me.
Excellent. Well, if I can change one life in a day, that's all I ask. Bruce J. Friedman, thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today. It was such an honor.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, sir.
Hello, this is novelist Michael Connelly, and you're listening to Mr. Media.